there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
How did Ann Patchett spend her pandemic? Writing a new collection of essays. Ann will be here to talk about that book, These Precious Days. And what goes into editing a collection of books about the Constitution? Political scientist Corey Brettschneider will join us to talk about the Penguin Liberty series. Alexandra Alter will be here to talk about what's going on in the publishing world. Plus, our critics will join us to talk about the books they've been reading and reviewing. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's November 26th. I'm Pamela Paul. Ann Patchett joins us now. She is, of course, a novelist and essayist, a co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville, which celebrates its 10th anniversary this week. And she joins us from Nashville. Ann, thanks for being here.
Hi, Pamela. Thank you for having me.
So we are here to talk about your most recent book, which is called These Precious Days. It is a collection of essays. This is your first essay collection in how many years? Because This Is the Story of a Happy Marriage came out when?
Are you just going to ask me the really hard stumping questions right off the bat?
Yeah, math questions.
I think it was 8 years ago. Let's just say it was 8 years ago.
Okay, because I have such a distinct memory of reading that book. I read it by our fireplace in Vermont and just sank in. And alas, this time I read this in a pandemic in my house / office / prison. So it wasn't quite the same reading experience, but also a completely delightful collection. In the introduction, you write that 2020 didn't seem like a great time to start a novel. Is that why you turned to a collection of essays?
Yes. And also, it wasn't that I thought, now I'm going to write a collection of essays. It was, I don't have anything to do today. Maybe I'll write an essay. I wasn't writing a book. I was just taking it one essay at a time.
What was your pandemic like?
Well, my pandemic, I hate to say it was great because, of course, the pandemic wasn't great. But novelists have been in training for this their whole lives. You know, we just really have good skill sets of staying in and being alone and working in our homes without direction. I have a nice house. I have a good marriage. My friend Sookie wound up getting stuck with us for a long period of time. So all of that was really good. And even the bookstore, which we thought was going to go under and we would lose everything, people were so wonderful. Customers ordered their books from us. We wouldn't let them in the store. We brought the books out to the cars. It was very moving, the whole thing, just of how really wonderful people were to the bookstore.
You mentioned Sookie, and she's obviously sort of the primary figure in the title essay for this collection, These Precious Days. And you write in that you didn't realize until you wrote that essay that this was a book. Why is that?
Well, that essay was so long. It was over 20,000 words. It was 60 pages. I didn't think that I would be able to do anything with it. And I really wasn't writing it thinking about publishing it. I just was writing it to document this experience that Sookie and I had. And then through a very strange twist of fate, it wound up getting published in Harper's Magazine. It had a really, really positive response. And I thought, I have all of these other essays that I've been writing, and I want to put it together and make it a book.
Well, let's talk about that essay. Let's just start there, because now people are like, who is Sookie? Tell us how you met her.
I met Sookie Raphael for a few minutes in Washington, D.C. around 3 years ago, and maybe even more than that now. I am really bad with time. Do you find that in the pandemic? Like, you have no idea how long anything's been going on?
Oh, no, time has no meaning, nor space. You know, I feel like this actually is maybe a good time for like just saying like, whatever, it's a metaverse, no matter how we feel about that particular company, because time and space have lost all meaning.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. So, I mean, I don't remember when Happy Marriage came out. I don't really remember when I met Sookie, because it feels like it was a week ago. But I had gone to Washington, D.C. to interview Tom Hanks for his short story collection, Uncommon Type. Sookie was Tom's assistant. I met her briefly backstage. And as it happens, every now and then in my life, I will meet someone very briefly and think, oh, I wish you lived next door. I wish you were my best friend. I wish I knew you. And I felt that way about Sookie, which is really funny because, of course, the person I was there to meet was Tom Hanks. And I was like, wait, could you step aside? I just really want to talk to your assistant.
Your assistant. Move aside, celebrity.
Your assistant is so dazzling. And then Tom and I stayed in touch because he was interested in bookstores. And then he wound up doing the audiobook for The Dutch House. So Sookie and I stayed in touch because of that. And we would email each other, I mean, maybe once a month, these very affectionate, sweet emails. And then it turns out she got pancreatic cancer after we met. She had a Whipple. She had the chemo and radiation. She was pronounced cancer-free. Again, I'm not a key player in her life. I'm hearing from her maybe once a month. I have very little information. But then she has a recurrence. The cancer comes back. And she's trying to get into a clinical trial for recurrent pancreatic cancer as fast as she can. And she can't find a trial that matches her cancer and has an opening. My husband, Carl, is a doctor. I mentioned this to him very offhandedly. And he finds her a place in the clinical trial at the hospital where he works in Nashville. She comes out here. She's going to be in this trial for 2 weeks. And then she's going to go back to Los Angeles, because then UCLA is starting the same trial. But in those 2 weeks, the pandemic begins. And it is like we were shipwrecked together. The trial at UCLA was canceled. The flights home were canceled. She just lived with us.
And why these precious days? Why that name for the essay?
Because they were. I mean, they were just beautiful, beautiful days. And Carl wasn't going to work. He was doing telemedicine. I was upstairs in my office writing essays. Sookie was downstairs painting. She was a brilliant painter, and she didn't want to lose 1 minute of this sudden free time she found herself with. And the days were truly wonderful. I used to say to Carl all the time, I can't believe she got stuck here with us. Like, everybody would have wanted her, her husband, her children, her friends, her sisters, everybody would have wanted Sookie to get stuck with them. And for unimaginable reasons, she got stuck with us. And it was that kind of friendship that you make in college when you are sharing a tiny bedroom with a stranger. We just had so much time, and we cooked and we exercised and we walked and we talked about everything, but mainly it was just all about art.
It was like a combination WeWork and Yaddo in your house.
Yes. Yes, it was, but without all of those other pesky people around.
Right. You write also that, you know, essays have never filled your days, coming back to this idea of days and time, that they remind you that you're still a writer when you're not writing a novel. What do you mean by that? Is it just like the act of sitting there at the, I don't know if you use a typewriter or a computer or write by longhand?
I use a computer. And actually, I write essays while I'm writing novels too sometimes, but it's wonderful to have something you can finish. You know, I can start a novel and it will take me 3 years sometimes to finish it, and no one reads it as I'm writing it. So if I write an essay, it's almost like sending up a flare saying, I'm still here, I'm still alive. I'm a very project-oriented person, and somehow writing an essay feels closer to, say, making Thanksgiving dinner than it does writing a novel. It's like, oh, I'm going to do this and it's going to take me a couple of days, but it's not going to take me years.
One of the things I love about you, Anne, is that you have really strong opinions and you don't hesitate to say them. And I remember I saw you at the National Book Awards a few years ago and you complimented my dress. And then you asked me where I got it. I sent you the website and you wrote back and said, those are the ugliest clothes I've ever seen in my life. You know, you just didn't hold back. And so in the essay, There Are No Children Here, you write...
Wait. No, we have to stay on this for 1 second. Because what I said was, they were the ugliest clothes I've ever seen. But your dress was so beautiful. I mean, I can picture that dress in my mind. I loved it so much. So why I was even saying that was the idea that you went to the website of ugly dresses and found the most magnificent dress I'd seen in years. I was just saying, you know, hats off to you, because I would have gotten one page into that website and thought, oh, hell no. But there was one beautiful dress buried in there and you found it.
Well, maybe I spent like way too much time on that website while you were writing a novel. But in that essay, in There Are No Children Here, you write, how I came not to care about other people's opinions is something of a mystery, even to me. I mean, talk about that, because you don't care.
And I think that these days that has everything to do with not being on the internet, because I think that that would just be paralyzing in terms of having an opinion about anything. If you had some sense that the angry villagers were coming at you with their torches, you might really be afraid. But because I don't look, it really just seems fine. And I never think that I am saying, this is what you should do. I'm just saying, this is what I do. This is what I like. This is what I believe, not what anybody else should like or believe. I don't think there's anything so radical about that. I always connect this to you, but I was the person who loved American Dirt.
I was about to bring that up because I remember you were like, I don't care what anyone else thinks. I liked it, but keep go on.
I did like it. And Janine Cummings, Parnassus was the second stop on her book tour. So she was at my store when all hell broke loose and she started getting death threats. And I'd never met her before, but I said, you know, don't go to a hotel, come home, spend the night with us. And she did. And we really have become quite close, which has nothing to do with the fact that I like the book. I blurbed the book. I like the book from the get-go. But then she caught fire like nothing I've ever witnessed. And I kept saying, you know, what can I do? Do you want me to write a piece? Do you want me to speak out in some way? And she was like, don't. I am under the wheels of the bus. Don't come with me. I don't want to see you get squashed. And I think that my lack of awareness of the vitriol and hatred that's out there on the internet that was just pouring down on her. It was very kind. She really wanted, I wanted to help her, but she really wanted to protect me.
Let's give listeners, maybe between the two of us, we can cobble together a few facts, just a little bit of a primer on American Dirt by Janine Cummings, which was a novel that came out, believe it or not, in 2020. Again, going back to the senselessness of time, it feels like about 17 years ago, but for those who sat out that whole thing with Ann Patchett on the sidelines of the internet, this was a novel that came out in early 2020. It had enormous amount of buzz. And that buzz, I remember at Book Expo, and we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast elsewhere, at Book Expo, all the booksellers, that if they asked them what book were they excited about, that was the book. But when it came out, and just before it came out, there were some angry voices on Twitter saying that Janine Cummings had written a novel about Mexican refugees crossing the border, which was an experience that she didn't have firsthand experience with and that was not qualified, therefore, to write about it. And then other people said, well, maybe she was qualified, but she didn't write about it well. And then still others, of course, loved the book, and it was a huge bestseller. So all of the literary Twitter anger and online opinionating didn't seem to get too much in the way. But what was it like from your perspective as a bookseller and a reader?
As a bookseller, we sold the book, and I think a lot of people really loved it. To me, though, it was a story about a woman making money. It was a story about Jeanine Cummings making a lot of money and getting a big advance. If she had written that book and published it and had gotten a $15,000 advance, everyone would have talked about what a great book it was. I think that the rage was over the fact that she made a lot of money, which was not her fault. I went to school with a woman who's a songwriter, a real old-time folk Americana songwriter. And she was in the Times a couple of months ago because she had written an album of songs giving voice to migrants crossing the border from Mexico. And the Times hailed it as, isn't it fantastic that she's written these beautiful songs, giving voice to the voiceless, doing them such great justice and honor. Well, this person is poor and makes no money off of her music. And therefore, as a woman making no money, singing songs about people who are doing the same thing that people were doing in Jeanine's book, that's okay. But I think that it's not okay when a woman makes a whole lot of money. And that's what enraged me about the whole thing.
All right. Well, moving on from our Jeanine Cummings micro podcast, one of my favorite essays in this collection is called, and it's just, I really like the title too. It's just what it is. A Talk to the Association of Graduate School Deans. I mean, talk about trying to alienate your reader, Anne, but I have to say, it was so great. And one of the things you write is, after 2 years in workshops, I would say it's almost impossible to hurt my feelings. And that has served me well through eviscerating reviews and all manner of internet weirdness. Do you want to add on to that at all?
Well, it is really true. I mean, when people say, what do you get out of an MFA? And I always think, yeah, you learn who to listen to. Just that. You just learn who to trust and who to ignore, because people will give you bad advice all the time. And as far as no matter of internet weirdness, there has certainly been some internet weirdness about me over the years. And my friends will call and say, there's something going around about you, kind of like a virus. And just, you know, just don't look. Just don't look at it. Don't read it. Don't know it. And I always say, gosh, thank you so much. And I follow that advice exactly. There was, around the publication of Truth and Beauty, there was some really hateful stuff about me going around. And I never looked at it, at the advice of my friends. But it was interesting. I mean, this is almost 20 years later. And people who are interviewing me will still say, can we talk about those horrible things about you on the internet when this book came out? And I'll say, no, I never looked at them. And they'll say, oh, well, I can read it to you right now. And I say, well, then what would the point? You think that I just didn't read this for 20 years because I didn't know how to read it?
Right. Also, that's a really weird conversation opener. Like, this really terrible thing happened. Would you like to discuss it and revisit it? Because it probably wasn't painful enough at the time.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that is a corollary of that. When I'm on book tour, if I get a really horrible review, people will cut it out and bring it to me and give it to me at the signing table, sliding it over and saying in a very, very sad tone, I don't know if you saw this. No one has ever in my life cut out a great review and brought it to me at a book signing.
I don't even know what to say to that. That's a very odd impulse. That's like, it's not passive aggressive. It might just be aggressive aggressive. I don't know. So earlier you said, you know, These Precious Days is 20,000 words, and some of these essays are really short. I think something that people are curious about with novels, obviously, but also with essays is, how do you know when it's over? You know, how do you know when it's at an end? And then similarly with a collection, how do you know, oh, this all comes together and makes a whole book?
I absolutely know when I get to the end of something. And in terms of when I'm writing, if it's a novel or an essay, that doesn't always mean that I did a good job with the ending. And my friends who are readers will often send me back and say, oh, you need to work on that ending, the last two sentences more. I always attribute that to studying painting and drawing, that you can overwork something, that you have to know when to lift your brush, because if you don't, you can really ruin something. So I think that that part of my brain kicks in. As far as knowing when a collection is done, what I do is I put the whole thing together and then I will give it to one friend and I will say, who is the weak sister? What's the worst essay in the book? And a person will only tell you one. They will never come back and say, oh, well, these three really have to go. They'll say, this is the one that's not as good as the others. And I'll take it out. I'll write a new one. I'll give it to another friend, the collection. What do you think is the weak sister? I'll take that out. I'll write another one. And I'll do that several times. And that has so much to do with how the book is shaped. The last person to read the book was my editor, Jonathan Burnham, who I adore. And there was in the book a long profile that I had written of Reese Witherspoon for Vanity Fair. And I thought it was a really good piece because it talked about feminism and her work in the industry. She's such an interesting person. And Jonathan called me and he said, you know, I'm really sorry, but I think you should think about taking the Reese Witherspoon piece out because it just doesn't fit. And then I thought, oh gosh, that was so long. And now it feels like there's a big hole in the book. And that's why I wrote There Are No Children Here.
Speaking of endings, we're at the end of our time here, but people would be really angry if I let you go without asking the author of Commonwealth and Pulitzer Prize finalist The Dutch House and Bel Canto and State of Wonder and several other novels. What's coming next novel-wise for you? Are you working on a new one now?
I am. And it's a book that I have been thinking about for about 3 years. I've started it. I feel really ready to go. I stopped it because I'm doing publicity for the essays. And I stopped it to write all of the essays. But that's kind of my happiest place when there's a book that's just been hanging around for a really, really long time. And so I feel like as soon as I have the time, I'll sit down and it will all come together. I interviewed Colson Whitehead a couple of days ago, and he was talking about the fact that he thought about Underground Railroad for 14 years, and that he thought about Harlem Shuffle for 7 years before he started writing those books, and that they came really smoothly because they had just been living with him. So I'm hoping that that's going to be the case, but I'm really excited to get back to fiction. Nothing like writing about real people to make you want to write about the people that you've made up.
Well, hurry up and come back on the podcast when that comes out.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
A total pleasure here too, Anne. The new book is called These Precious Days. It's by Anne Patchett. She is the author, of course, of many books, including another essay collection, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, many novels, and two children's books, Lambslide and The Scapegoat. Maybe we can talk about those next time. And she is a multi-hyphenate novelist, essayist, bookstore owner, Anne Patchett. Anne, thanks again.
Thanks, Pamela.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
You've heard me talk before about our biggest list of the year, which comes out at the end of this month. It's the 10 best books of the year, 2021 in this case. And if you're a Times subscriber, we hope you'll join us on the morning of November 30th for a virtual live edition of this podcast where we'll announce the list for the very first time before it gets published. I'll be joined, of course, by my book review colleagues here and many of the people you know from the podcast, and also actor, writer, and producer Lena Waithe, who recently announced that she'll be starting her own book imprint, will kick us off with a welcome. Afterwards, like last year, we're holding a virtual after party where we want to hear from you about your favorite books published this year. You can RSVP at nytimes.com/10bestbooks. That's 10, T-E-N, spelled out with letters. Corey Brett Schneider joins us now. He is a professor of political science at Brown University and the editor of a series of books from Penguin Classics called the Penguin Liberty Series. Corey, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
I want to ask first about your day job. What's your area of focus and research in political science?
I teach constitutional law and political theory, and I'm particularly interested in civil liberties and their connection to democracy. So in the tradition of the Brown professor, Alexander Micklejohn, I'm really concerned to think about the role of free speech and religious freedom in our democracy.
All right. Well, then clearly you were meant to do this series. Was this your idea, the Penguin Liberty series? Did you come to the publisher and say, hey, this is something I want to do? Or did Penguin come to you? How did it come about?
Penguin came to me with a broad idea, which was to try to think about civics more generally in what was obviously a tumultuous time early in the Trump administration. And they said, well, what do you want to do? How would you like to think about this? And my answer was that I wanted to think about the role of, as I just said, free speech, religious freedom, the fundamentals that you hear discussed a lot, but to really go deep. I guess I was also concerned to put together a book that wasn't just one view, but was a clash of opinions in a time in which people were doing anything but deliberating and reasoning.
So most people don't have the set of nice little books in front of them. I want to describe them physically, and then you can tell me kind of the big idea behind them. So I have four of them. There are two that have been out, I think, since 2020, and two that are just out this month. And they are beautifully designed. Of course, it's Penguin Classics, and they do really nice paperbacks, little slender paperbacks that are narrow and can kind of fit in your pocket, depending on, I guess, the size of your pants. But they're easily portable collections of essays on a series of subjects. But you expand on that, because I mostly describe the aesthetics.
I think that matters, that they're meant to be accessible. These are books that are certainly taught in classes, but our idea and our hope was to get the general public interested in them, to have it as the kind of thing that you could sit around the dinner table and talk about selections from the free speech volume or the religious freedom volume. And the thought was, too, to make them look beautiful, which they do, and to have them easily available as gifts, as a way of getting discussions started. We've seen so many families, I think, divided over politics during the Trump era. And this is a way of trying to get families really talking to one another, and not just talking in the most shallow way about events or reciting opinions, and certainly not, you know, just talking past one another, but to give a kind of common vocabulary. So, for instance, the volume on religious freedom has excerpts from Madison, who you hear a lot about, but what did he actually think about religious freedom? And you couldn't have a bigger contrast, for instance, between that and the remarks recently of Michael Flynn talking about how America is a Christian republic. You see Madison instead talking about the contrary idea that we ban the establishment of religion. So anyway, these sorts of pieces are meant to create dialogue, and they're edited in a way so that they're accessible. We took out anything that would require you to know constitutional law the way that a lawyer would, or the way someone would argue in court. Instead, we're looking really for the values and principles that each of these selections brings to the table.
So I'm going to just run down the four titles that are out now, and then we can talk a little bit more about the specifics in each book. But the books are On Impeachment, The Presidency on Trial, which came out in September 2020, along with Decisions and Dissents of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And then this month, two new volumes, Religious Freedom, which you mentioned, and of course, Free Speech. Well, they seem of a whole. The first two volumes feel like there's this stuff in the news. There's this stuff in the news. Like, let's give some background. And then these more recent volumes feel like, okay, now let's step back and look at the broader issues here. Is that my imagination?
No, I think that's right. And, you know, there are different ways into talking about the big ideas of liberty. One way is to take a biography of somebody who, to my mind, is the most important litigator, certainly when it came to women's rights and Supreme Court justice, when it came to not just women's rights, but thinking about the role of equality in the context of our larger project of democracy and freedom. And so Justice Ginsburg, as much as she is an icon and discussed in terms of her biography, the way the volume works is it really brings us into her ideas about equality and equal protection. And with On Impeachment, I'm pretty sure we designed it before the first impeachment, but there was a thought that, look, you know, this is a topical, specific topic that is likely to be in the news. That was my prediction. And I had just written a book called The Oath in the Office that was about everything you needed to know about the Constitution if you wanted to be president. And we wanted to focus in on one of those kind of topics that would likely be relevant. But the idea was, again, to bring us beyond the moment. And so impeachment isn't just any ordinary procedure in our Constitution. It's really the final way that Congress is supposed to have of defending our freedom, defending our democracy. Now, that might have sounded very dramatic when the book came out, but when you see what the second impeachment was about, it really was about preventing an insurrection, preventing our democracy from collapsing. So there, too, I think there might be a worry, oh, this is some weird side topic. But no, it turned out to be, because of history, a volume that is, I would say, at the center of what political freedom in the United States means.
It does seem that in popular discourse and political rhetoric and on cable news, et cetera, when we talk about freedom, it's often talked about in terms of freedom from this, instead of, it sounds like what you're saying, freedom to do things, freedom to be certain things.
Right. And I would say, just adding to that, I think that's right, that there are multiple dimensions of freedom. Certainly not having the government come in and arrest you for speaking in the wrong way or for exercising your religion is part of it. But what the volume really wants us to do is to think about more complicated ideas of freedom. And one of them is the fact that we determine our freedoms as part of being members of a democracy. And free speech and religious freedom, part of the argument is, we just can't understand what these individual liberties are without thinking of them in the wider context. So I'll come back to my really favorite, as you can tell, thinker in the volume, and I do have a favorite, and that's Alexander Micheljohn, who gives us a metaphor for thinking about the relationship between democracy and freedom, and that's the town meeting. He says, imagine that we're all in a town meeting, and the moderator begins to intervene, cutting people off based on whether or not they're saying the right thing, whether or not they're saying something that the moderator, for instance, agrees with. So imagine we're talking about building a bridge on the north side of town or the south side of town, and the moderator decides, you know, those people defending the north side of town, that's just a ridiculous argument, I'm going to cut them off. Micheljohn's point is that denies something, not just in our basic right of expression and the ability to speak, but the ability in a democracy to hear all arguments, to determine for ourselves as citizens what we think, and to make informed opinions. It puts deliberation at the center of not just democracy, but also political freedom. And so that to me is a huge part of what the volume is about. In the Religious Freedom volume too, the idea that, yes, you're free to practice your religion, but you're also free to not have the government impose its idea of religion on you, whether that be through taxation or through laws that resemble a Christian republic. As the Constitution puts it, not only is there a ban on establishment, but there's a ban on laws that respect an establishment of religion, and respect there means relate to. So it's a multidimensional idea of liberty and centered around the idea, not just, as you say, exactly, not of just freedom from intervention, but also what it means to be free in a democracy.
That sounds so lovely and foreign right now. Anyways,
that's the idea of the volume.
I want to talk about the intended reader, because earlier, you know, you said something about families disagreeing, and this episode will be dropping right after Thanksgiving, when people are probably immersed in arguing with their families, you know, extended and immediate and otherwise. I'm curious, who is your intended reader here? Did you think of it primarily as students? Did you think of this as something to be assigned in classes?
I think that's part of it. I certainly would hope that professors would use this. But really, I think if we're going to continue on as a democracy, and I don't think that as we learn about January 6th, that this is hyperbole. I think that we are under threat when it comes to a very different idea of what government is supposed to look like that's prevailing in much of the public right now. And how are we to combat it? I think in order to really take seriously the idea that we're going to defend liberty in any defensible, robust sense, we have to know what it is. And that means that citizens have to think about these things. So I don't know if it's a pie in the sky ambition. You know, some of these volumes actually are doing quite well, but my hope is that this is going to have a wide readership in America, that it will be part of a national conversation. I'd like to see a common set of readings in thinking about democracy for the nation, not just for students who are, you know, in college or in high school.
You tried to get a variety of perspectives in each of these books, which again is unusual for our times. How do you balance that with you are furthering an argument at the same time?
Absolutely. I think that there is within these ideas of democracy and liberty a really legitimate and robust discussion about how to balance equality and free speech, which is a lot of the discussion or a lot of the debate, as I'd put it, in the free speech volume, for instance. The way to think about the limits on religious freedom when it comes to the establishment of religion, for instance, the question of the kind of prayer, if any, that we should allow in town meetings or in public spaces. Those are all, to me, arguments that a healthy democracy discusses. But at the same time, a healthy democracy has to leave out certain views and has to, I think, challenge them directly. So I do in the volume, in the introduction, not include fascistic viewpoints, for instance, or white nationalist viewpoints. And those do have a role in American history. Certainly, they played a prevalent role, not just at points, you know, in the early 20th century, in the 19th century, when we're talking about white supremacy in 18th century, of course. But I don't think those are views that we should think of as within the realm of reasonable disagreement within democracy.
At this moment, free speech feels like it's coming under threat from all sides, all corners, from the right, from the left, from people who would probably consider themselves politically conservative to those who would consider themselves politically progressive. How do you capture that in this book? The pieces that you include are obviously older, some of them obviously from the constitutional period. There are some more recent ones, including the New York Times Company versus Sullivan from 1964. Yeah. Did you try to get at that interesting moment through these earlier pieces?
Exactly. And as you say, it really speaks to the news that we're seeing every day and debates going on about free speech right now. Out of a belief that if you look at, you know, John Stuart Mill, for instance, who I would say anchors the volume, that he gives us a way of thinking about free speech that's neither right nor left. And his argument is maybe too optimistic for our time, but I think we have to begin with it. And it suggests that deliberation and discussion, robust reasoning, isn't just a good thing, but that ultimately it will result in the truth, that it will result in a society that is worth preserving, and that we should trust in free speech if it's accompanied by, and this is essential, and this ties into the volumes too, robust education, the ability not just to read and think, but to deliberate. And I think that is a great beginning for our time in thinking about it, that free speech isn't just about saying what you want. It's not a free-for-all. It's supposed to serve a purpose in democracy. Another piece that we have here that really hasn't been published, I don't think, since 1968, is Alexander Micklejohn's piece about democracy that I mentioned earlier, also providing a very, not just a defense of deliberation, but again, pointing out its role in democracy, the ability to hear all arguments, not just to make all arguments. And then when you look at the case law, I think in the United States, we have such a robust case law in protecting free speech, notably, I know I'm on a Times podcast, so I'm not trying to kiss up, but that case.
No, go ahead. You can kiss up. It's fine.
Times versus Sullivan, which is, of course, not just about the New York Times, but it's about the rights of the civil rights movement, defenders of Martin Luther King, to speak in a way that might involve small errors and not be sued into oblivion. And that victory really preserved not just the ability of the New York Times to do its job, but the civil rights movement to carry on in criticizing Southern segregationists. Fundamental for democracy to allow for that kind of robust free speech. But yet, on the other hand, I include voices that see contemporary America in a different way, especially when it comes to hate speech, to think about within democracy the idea that, look, if Mill is wrong and far from truth prevailing, if white supremacy prevails, then the whole thing is lost. And so maybe we should look to the rest of the world, which doesn't have quite the same kind of protections. The U.S. has the most protective free speech in the world. The rest of the world limits hate speech, limits Holocaust denial, limits certain kinds of racist speech. And so we have voices making that point here. And I think of that as an argument from within democracy. And it leaves room, too, for a third view, a view that I favor, which is, look, it's possible to both protect all viewpoints from criminalization, but also have a government that's devoted to promoting certain ideals, the idea of equality under law, anti-white supremacy. And that can be done not just through putting people in prison, but through, and this again ties into the volume, but through education and through promulgating the idea of deliberation.
You mentioned hate speech and the discussion about whether hate speech is the same as violence or if it incites violence is obviously a subject, a conversation that's been raging for the last few years. The other one with regard to free speech is just misinformation. And I wonder if any of the selections that you have in here get at that, like if blatant falsehoods are being put forth.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm so excited to try to introduce John Stuart Mill, whose name people have heard but haven't read. When you read him on that precise question, he's so on point. And I'll just tell you what he says about blatant falsehoods. He says, look, speech in public and public discourse can be divided into three categories. Some things are true, and you don't want to ban those. Some things are partially true, and some things are not true at all. They're totally false. What's the argument for preserving the falsehoods? And really the centerpiece of his argument is that it allows us to clarify our own arguments, and that if we don't do that, if we don't allow falsehood, then deliberation is going to get lost. We're going to hold things at the level of dogma rather than at the level of truth. And the reason to allow partially true ideas as well is that over time, the false part will fall out and the true part will win out. Now, that isn't just some random idea or some philosopher's idea. It's really the idea at the core of our First Amendment as it's understood in the 20th century. For instance, Justice Holmes was a huge fan of Mill. And although he didn't go far enough in protecting free speech, the extent that he did advocate protecting it is, I think, based on that argument I just gave you. But it also, I mean, of course, we could have a great discussion and at these Thanksgiving tables, I hope people will have a great discussion about whether that still holds in an age of social media when algorithms are dominating and showing us falsehood after falsehood. Because what Mill really thought was it was going to be the clash of the true and false, the counter-argument to the false that was going to bring about truth in the end, in the bigger sense, long-term. And if we're not in a position where we're encountering true ideas, if falsehood is spreading unchecked, as it is, we know in social media and Facebook, for instance, that's a real concern.
You teach at Brown University, an Ivy League school. There's a lot of discussion about free speech on campuses, about what people can be free or not free to say in a seminar or who can be invited to speak. And I remember when I was there long, long time ago, Justice Scalia came to campus and there was no controversy at the time around him coming. It was a packed hall. People were really excited. I think many people on that campus wanted to go at him. And he kind of wiped the floor with us. He obviously a very skilled arguer, but I wonder what it's like there right now and how you feel about all those issues around who can say what and who is free to come and to speak. And does the conversation feel open both inside the classroom and outside the classroom on campus these days?
I'll say inside the classroom, I mean, I've devoted my career to trying to do exactly what you're talking about, to introduce students not just to the views that they're familiar with, but to different ways of thinking. And that doesn't mean just mean like conservative as opposed to liberal or left as opposed to right, but it means, you know, really thinking philosophically. And so that Mill argument I gave you, is that a left argument or a right argument? Students aren't so sure. And so when they hear it, they really take it in and think about it. Or Micklejohn, which a lot of things at Brown are named after, although nobody's usually read him until they come into these classes or look at these volumes, I hope. Is that argument about democracy and free speech a left argument or a right argument? So I think if you present the full, not familiar ways of talking about these things, but the deep philosophical arguments, people don't have an immediate reaction, and certainly students are forced to think about it. So in my classroom, and now here's another chance to kiss up to the interviewer, a Brown alum. I mean, I'm really seeing the full minds of these students, and I don't see them just shutting down discussion or any of those sorts of questions. Now, we've had a lot of controversies about outside the question, who do you invite and who don't you invite? And I'll just tell you what I think. I mean, to my mind, I agree with much in, for instance, the Chicago Principles on Free Speech, which talk about the idea that no student certainly should be punished for any opinion. And I think that. I think certainly even if you have an opinion that is contrary to all the things I've been saying about democracy, even I would go so far as to say if you defend fascism, you shouldn't be punished for those views, shouldn't be expelled, for instance, from any university. And that's the principle of viewpoint neutrality that the Chicago Principles on Free Speech defend. But I also advocate a separate view, which is that in addition to that protection, that the university does have to take a stand in favor of reasoning, in favor of deliberation. And so when it comes to the question of who to invite, you know, I take a sort of subtle line. I think certainly if you're going to give an award to somebody or an endowed lecture, I don't see it as equal to take the Southern segregationist and take the free speech leader or to take the fascist and the anti-fascist. I think that universities should be promoting the idea of democracy and defending it against its opponents. And there are real opponents right now. But that doesn't mean at the same time that we shut down all opposition. So if a student group wants to, and this is part, I think, of the rights of students, to invite even Milo to speak on campus, that was a Berkeley controversy, or to invite, we could talk about Michael Flynn, whose remarks are the opposite of what I'm trying to do in the free speech volume. They are in support of theocracy. I'm fine with that. Students have a right, as Micklejohn says, to hear all viewpoints, to engage the way we've talked about. But I think the university at the same time has to find ways to protect students, but also to defend democracy.
All right. I only have time for one more question. So it's going to be forward looking. There are two more books currently slated for the series, one on Hamilton and the other one, which I think sounds like tremendous fun. I hesitate using that word because it's just obviously I have my own sense of fun, but the classic Supreme Court cases. And I just wonder, how do you narrow it down?
The main things that I'm doing is to ensure that it isn't the celebration of the Supreme Court that you sometimes see in sort of high school civics. The Supreme Court has had great moments, and we talked about New York Times versus Sullivan as one of them, and certainly there are other iconic ones like that, Brown versus Board of Ed.
You're going to put in the bad ones, too.
We have to talk about not just the bad ones, but I would even say the evil ones. So the Dred Scott opinion denying legal personhood to African Americans when it comes to questions of standing to a formerly enslaved person who had been formerly enslaved and then been in a free territory. And the question was whether or not he even had legal personhood, the right to appear in court. And the Supreme Court says no. Plessy versus Ferguson, of course, claiming falsely that separate is somehow equal. Those moments in Supreme Court history and in the free speech volume, I have the Alien Sedition Acts right up front, the moment where John Adams with his party shut down free speech. We have to talk about not just the moments of glory in which institutions like the Supreme Court defended liberty, but also those in which it really engaged in an attack on it.
All right. The titles that are available now are On Impeachment, Decisions and Dissents of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Free Speech, and Religious Freedom, all of them part of the Penguin Liberty series, which is edited by Corey Brettschneider. Corey, thanks so much again for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with some news in the publishing world. Hey, Alexandra.
Hey, Pamela. So we got some interesting news last week about a book coming out from former President Donald J. Trump. Of course, everyone's been talking about whether he will eventually publish a memoir, which is a standard move for former presidents. This book is not that. It is a photo book that he has written the captions for, and it's being published by this new company called Winning Team Press. It's not being published through one of the big five. Rather, this publishing company was co-founded by his son, Donald Trump Jr., and Sergio Gore, who worked for Mr. Trump's re-election campaign in 2020. So Elizabeth Harris and I reported on this last week. And what's interesting is, you know, this book certainly seems to be selling well through pre-orders on Amazon. And it is aggressively priced, although not for a photo book, but I think by the standards of most books, it's $74.99 or $229.99 for a signed copy. And it's being sold through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and this website, 45 Books, which was developed by Winning Team Press. This company says they have other authors lined up. They haven't revealed who those authors might be, but they're an interesting example of a new phenomenon we're seeing in the publishing world, which is that, you know, we've always had polarization in publishing. There's been conservative imprints for decades that have lived within the larger publishing companies. For example, Penguin Random House has theirs. Simon Schuster has Threshold Editions, which in fact has published previous books by Mr. Trump. All the big companies tend to have an outlet for conservative politicians and conservative voices. But recently, we've seen new companies springing up that are catering more to the MAGA movement. There is a new company led by Kate Harson and Louise Burke, who both ran conservative imprints at major publishers. Their company is called All Seasons. And they've said specifically that they are catering to voices on the right that might not find a home in mainstream publishing companies. This has been something that we've seen happening in the era after Trump, when a lot of people who were aligned with him maybe have books to publish and maybe aren't finding their ideas are well received by traditional publishers. Another new publishing division that was announced recently is from the Daily Wire. It was created by the Daily Wire co-founder Ben Shapiro, and it's going to be launching next spring. It'll be interesting to see how books perform from these imprints, if they get the big distribution and big audiences. Certainly, they seem to be finding authors who already have a following and a platform. We already saw, as I mentioned, that this photo book is doing quite well on Amazon, and it's called Our Journey Together. It has 300 photographs. It'll be interesting to see how that does. And also, Mr. Trump has said that he has a memoir that he's been writing, or rather, he didn't call it a memoir. He said he's writing the book of all books. There's a question of if and when he is ready to publish that, if he goes to one of the big five houses and gets a multi-million dollar deal, or if he decides to go a different route.
All right. I found a few interesting things in the details here. One is the fact that in his announcement email, former President Trump says that the book is being proudly printed in the United States. And that's kind of unusual for a coffee table book or picture book, right? Because most of them are printed in China these days. I don't know if that's changed because of supply chain issues or if this is just completely unusual.
Typically, for a large illustrated book or a photo book, most publishers will have those printed overseas. It's just much more cost effective. They have the facilities. And there is, as you said, these supply chain issues here, so that a book that requires an elaborate printing and production would be difficult to do here in the US. But that is indeed what they emphasize in their promotional material. And I don't know exactly where it's being printed or who's distributing it. We do know that it's going through some major retailers like Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and it's supposedly going on sale in early December. It's kind of being pitched as a holiday gift book also. So presumably they have those print copies lined up and are prepared to handle that kind of elaborate printing and distribution.
All right. Well, it sounds like the Trump book surge is not ending anytime soon.
Yeah, we're going to see, I think, a whole array of books coming from his administration that we've talked about previously on the podcast. So as we've said before, it seems like the appetite for political content is not abating.
Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us now are critics Dwight Garner and Alexander Jacobs. Hey, guys.
Hi, Pamela.
Hey.
Dwight, it's been a while. What have you been reviewing lately in our pages?
God, big 1,000-page books. Patricia Highsmith has a new, I mean, she died in 1995, but there's a new book of her diaries and notebooks out. It's called Patricia Highsmith, Her Diaries and Notebooks, 1941 to 1995. And I just loved it. It's one of the best. I mean, anyone who's read me in the Times over the years, I think, knows that I'm a big fan of less official genres. I mean, I like books of letters a lot, and I like diaries and journals and books of essays and travel writing and less official kinds of literature. And Highsmith's diaries are some of the best I've ever read.
Can I jump in and say one quick thing about unofficial kinds of literature?
Yeah.
And that is to say, because Dwight will not and cannot say it himself, that Dwight Garner's own unofficial weird kind of literature is out now in paperback, Garner's Quotations. And I was recently in many bookstores and it was always there on a front table.
Thanks, Pamela, for the plug. You know, it's out in paperback. I like to say that it reads like a book of poems because there are no categories in it. But alas, the hardcover sold like a book of poems. So, you know, I want this new one to move. So thank
this
you.
This one's going to move it's like a book move. Of quotations.
This is making me think of Jiminy Glick. Remember Jiminy Glick? And he'd go, plug away, plug away.
All right. I have plugged. Dwight, go back to Patricia Highsmith.
Oh, God, I would love to. You know, she was born in Texas, but grew up largely in New York City. And she went to Barnard. And by the time she was, you know, a junior and senior there, she was already, people knew that she was special. I mean, she was just very intelligent, very driven. She was very beautiful, and people had violent feelings about her just sexually. I mean, men and women threw themselves at her. And she was adopted by an elite sort of artistic group of bohemian lesbians in Greenwich Village. And she spent her time, these diaries just talk about her intense desire to work and all the writing she's doing. But at the same time, there's so many just restaurants and sex and travels, you know, affairs with married women and running around New York City. And she's so funny and smart and acid about it all. It's like, it's just lovely.
Did she write about her writing?
All the time. I mean, she would write for 8 hours a day. I mean, she was intense. She had a strong work ethic. I couldn't believe it. But as I said in my review, she pegged away all day at her writing and pegged away all night at her gin. She talks about once or twice having 7 martinis at a sitting. I mean, she must have been a titanic constitution because she drank an awful lot. But she's just good on everything, on what it's like to ride home late at night in a taxi cab or smoking in the back seat. And she's good on envy, and she's good on hate and love and everything that enlivens her fiction. In her journals, it's even somehow often more interesting.
Tell us how you feel about her fiction. What's your favorite Highsmith?
Well, I'm a Ripley guy, so I love the Tom Ripley novels. Some are better than others. You know, I've never read the book that's now known as Carol.
Turned into a film, a Todd Haynes film.
Todd Haynes film, yep, and which is a lovely film. When I was reading some of these sentences out loud to my wife, she's a big Highsmith fan too, but there's still a sense that Highsmith is sort of in the first rank of second rank writers, I would say, about how she's ranked. I'm not saying I feel that way necessarily, but I feel that way about her. And Cree said to me, my wife, well, you know, maybe she didn't drink so much, she'd be in the first rank of American writers, not at the very top of the second rank. And it's hard to know if that's true or not, but
I want to know who else is in the first rank of the second rank of writers.
Oh, I can't say. It's brutal. I'm writing an obituary now of a writer who I think is really good, but I almost want to say it, you know, because it's, you know, this person is very, very good, but sort of somehow never, how does one define these things? Never cracked the highest ranks, I think. We should make a list.
Yeah, that's the obituary phrase. Never quite achieved, never quite cracked.
I always think of Somerset Maugham when people say that because that they always say that of him too.
Maybe that should be on my tombstone. The top rank of the second rank of American critics.
You know, it's not a bad place to be. It's not. It could be worse, right?
It could. Well, anyway, last word about Highsmith. Let me just say that the first half of the journal, it's an enormous book. The first half is a must read. From ages 20 to about 45, there's her most intense journal keeping. She did it less so as she got older, and she became reclusive. And the journals fall off a little bit in terms of just what she's talking about. They become a little more rote, a little bit more work as the journals go on. And she became sort of dark and in many ways. People talk about her anti-Semitism. It doesn't come up much in these journals. There's only a line or two that's even anywhere close to that.
I wonder if it was edited out.
I don't think so. The editor makes a big point of not editing out anything for reasons of that. And, you know, we have to take her on her word, but I am willing to, that she's not covering for Highsmith because it wouldn't be smart. It'll come out someday, you know, because these journals will be made public at some point in their absolute entirety.
I wonder what the next rank down is from must read. Is it maybe read?
Maybe read. There should maybe be a shelf. Read. There should be a shelf in the bookstores that say that. Alexandra, what did you read this week?
Well, what I read this week was actually Will Smith's memoir. But what I'd love to talk about, delightful as Smith's memoir was On Consolation by Michael Ignatieff. And I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. The professor and former Canadian politician. It's a book that I think it looks like a self-help book. It's, you know, the jacket has this, I don't know if it's a moon or a sun, but, you know, it's something I can easily imagine finding on a table devoted to self-help. But it's self-help of the most erudite sort, because it's really a sort of tour of Western thinkers, philosophers, and Western thought on the subject of like our nothing less than our human condition and the fact that we're all going to die someday and how people come to grips with their mortality. I thought this was I think he started it before the pandemic, and it was a project that I think took on new relevance facing the despair and isolation that so many people were in.
What did you learn?
Yeah, did you take consolation from it?
You know, I did take it a little bit. Threw me back. I didn't say this in the review, but it a little bit threw me back to college days, in the sense that it's very great books. It's very core curriculum. In the beginning of the book, he sort of says, we're not going to be talking about Muslim thought, or, you know, he's confining himself to a very narrow classic slice of Western history. But, you know, once I accepted those boundaries, I really, really enjoyed it. It's just amazing to go through history and realize he really takes you to sort of some of the worst moments that there are, you know, the Holocaust, barbarians at the gate, like everything bad that's ever happened, not everything bad that's ever happened, but everything that's bad that's ever happened to an eloquent white male thinker is sort of covered in this book.
And wait, what else has he written? Like, I know.
Oh my
work.
Gosh, he's written like he's so much.
A lot of books.
I mean, yeah, we were. I think we didn't wind up putting in the precise number because we were worried about getting it precisely right. It's something like 20.
Any takeaways from this book? Like for those of us looking for consolation,
the book is aimed at non-believers. It presumes people reading it are not religious or they don't believe in God, or, you know, which is a big presumption to make. But I thought it was very interesting to think, well, you know, you can take solace from religious texts and certainly maybe even more so religious music and art, things that were created in the name of God, in the name of religion, even if you're a non-believer yourself. And that, in fact, there's a kind of belief that can be constructed just from that intergenerational, the intermillennial almost connectivity, which I thought was very, very wonderful, worth considering.
Well, what can I say? But thank you for that. This is our Thanksgiving episode. So it feels, I don't know, somehow in sync thematically. I don't know that I can say that for the Highsmith, Dwight.
Well, that's a different kind of Thanksgiving, if you know what I mean.
All right. Well, happy Thanksgiving to all. Thank you, Dwight and Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thank you, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.